It's Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 5, a judge has blamed a nursing home's weak management for allowing four members of staff to abuse elderly dementia sufferers. Three have been jailed at Preston Crown Court, with the other given a community order. Their carers mistreated eight victims in their 70s and 80s because they knew they wouldn't remember. Detective Inspector Andy Hume from Lancashire Police says it was sickening.
Their ill treatment was directed at some of the most vulnerable members of our community. These people couldn't speak out or defend themselves. Their behaviour was utterly contemptible, and I can only hope when they reflect on their actions, they see how cowardly their conduct has actually been.
A police officer will be sentenced next month after he admitted lying about witnessing the Downing Street Plebgate row. The former chief whip, Andrew Mitchell, who was forced to resign, says he's pleased justice has been done. Detectives say they're not looking for anyone else over the deaths of two young boys and a woman in northwest London. All three were found at a house near Harrow yesterday evening. The children, aged 7 months and 5 years, are thought to have been murdered. Leslie Gotts is a neighbour.
You don't expect anything like that. People say it on TV, but when it happened in your street, it was terrifying. I just felt chilled, icy, you know. When I went up to Sainsbury's to shop, I was almost in tears. I didn't even know the people.
Two 48-hour strikes have been announced on the London Underground. Members of the RMT union will walk out on February the 4th and the 11th in a row over ticket office closures. A French tabloid magazine, which claimed Francois Hollande was having an affair, says it will remove the report from its website. The president had threatened to sue the publishers of Closer, which linked him with an actress 18 years younger than him. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
BCFM. And weren't the girls brilliant today? Yes, it's Friday. It's 5 o'clock and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for St Paul's, that is actually officially Ashley Ward, that's Rob Telford. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Fallujah, Iraq. Remember the city devastated by coalition weapons when Iraq was invaded? Well, they're back. The West may control the Baghdad parliament, but not the hearts and minds of these Iraqis. Plus, Chancellor George Osborne sets out his stall this week. What does Martin Summers make of his speech on Monday, setting out the coalition, the Tory party, in fact, prospects for the next 5 or 6 years? And IBM and the Holocaust. We get to the root of the worries over mass data collection this week, something the Nazis were obsessed with too, and how the Americans, during the Second World War, via Switzerland, made a lot of money from helping them out. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 6 Celsius and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 9, sunny on Saturday, cloudier and windier on Sunday, with heavy showers overnight. Well, since there's so few sales around, probably best thing is to go out on Saturday and stay in on Sunday. Next week, highs of 9, plenty of sunshine this week, but also heavy showers and some gusty winds. Next weekend, that's the 18th and 19th of January, highs of 7 again, fairly wet and windy. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Green Councillor for St Paul's, otherwise known as Ashley. That is Rob Telford. Hi, Rob. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony.
First of all, how have you found your first nearly, well, it's not a year, is it? It's three quarters of a year or so as a councillor.
I found it quite engaging. Lots and lots of meetings and lots of people to talk to. And what I find is more and more people want engagement from me and want me to come to their events and talk to them and listen to what they've got to say about
and
things
how,
that are going on.
How is it being a councillor now compared to what your thoughts were beforehand when you stood?
I think it's probably pretty much what I thought. I mean, there's a lot more groups than I expected there to be. I mean, Ashley Ward is one of the most active in the whole city, so I think there's probably more in terms of community engagement than I even expected.
Well, yeah. Give us an idea of one of the groups first that you look forward to going to see, and then guess what the second one will be.
Okay, I always look forward to talking to St Paul's Unlimited because they do have a very interesting take on things. They always have a lot of different views in the room. All the people who are there always have an opinion, and that's the kind of environment you want to be in, where people are free to, you know, feel free to express their opinion and actually give you a good.
Isn't that the Neighbourhood Partnership?
It's part of the Neighbourhood Partnership.
How does that work? How is St Paul's Unlimited different to the Neighbourhood Partnership?
Well, St Paul's Unlimited actually is part. Technically, it's sort of a council-run thing. It's a coordinating body of people from the community who look after it. But there's a project development person who works full time there on the projects that people in St Paul's want. The Neighbourhood Partnership, in comparison, is a structure that covers a much larger area: Ashley, Easton, and Lawrence Hill. So a larger area of the inner city. So that's the difference, I suppose. And so St Paul's is looking just particularly at our area, I suppose. Yeah.
And what do you not look forward to? Which meetings do you really not look forward to?
Just all the council ones. I mean, different councillors come from different perspectives.
Oh, so what committees are you on? What meetings are you going to?
I go to Children, Young People and Skills. I sit on Elections and Democracy.
Do you find it a bit mind-numbing going to these council meetings then?
Pretty mind-numbing, yeah, I'll be absolutely honest with you. Some of them are incredibly positive and people get together and actually try and change things for the better in Bristol, but a lot of them are, to be honest, a waste of time.
But I mean, the thing is, what you're doing...
to say that.
in these meetings, I mean, what you're doing, essentially, is prioritising things, particularly budgets and looking at where money's being spent. A lot of this is our council tax payments and central government grants. Actually, surely that's actually the heart of what's going on in the council. What you're doing there is you're getting all this taxpayers' money and saying, well, actually, these are the priorities, this is where it should be spent. And that should be quite an exciting thing, surely.
It's actually quite rare that I make any decisions about money. In fact, in the Neighbourhood Partnership meetings is where we make most decisions about money as councillors.
Really?
Because that's where a lot of the allocation of funds comes down to that neighbourhood level now, and so actually that's where I make most of the decisions. The only place where I actually do make decisions about how money is spent is in the budget meetings, which is coming up in February. So that's quite obviously a big event in the council's year in terms of how we're going to deal with financing different services. And
so if you were Lord Ferguson, the great one,
yep.
How would you change the way the council operates to make these meetings more valuable, useful, interesting?
Well, that's...
Because I think most of us are thinking to ourselves, I mean, I certainly am, when I vote for you, I want you to be in there fighting for us, and I don't want you to be sitting in some stuffy, boring meeting, or falling half asleep.
Well, take what most people consider the biggest public-facing meeting we have, which is the full council meetings. We've been talking this week, actually, in a cross-party working group, about how we make it more... but just better, because it doesn't work. It always overruns. It's 4 or 5 hours long. It's not engaging for the public because they don't know when they're going to get their concerns.
I'm not sure how many people you get on the webcast. It must be about 3, maybe.
No, actually, the webcast is actually going up, actually.
Really?
In terms of the people who are using it. Mainly because people have realised
they can't watch the webcast. They can't be bothered
to
come down to the council house. Okay.
So actually, I think that's something to be said for trying to find a way of engaging people to come to the meetings, because I think actually it is really important to see the whites of your councillor's eyes and see what they think about these issues. That largely people don't get that opportunity.
But I mean, we keep hearing on this show again and again, essentially what the council's doing is it's managing a process of slow collapse, really. The cuts, less and less and less that the council's able to do. And it's very difficult to get people to get enthusiastic about our democratic system in this city. I mean, we've got whatever it is, something like 350,000 people relying on you guys to make the right decisions. And yet, all you seem to be doing is cutting.
Yes, completely. And that's the problem with it, is that because we're in this situation where we're being forced through the austerity measures that central government is placing on local authorities to cut so much from our budget, people feel like they don't have a voice in
that. So can you understand why people don't want to vote? I mean, we've got more voting coming up in May, and people think to themselves, well, what's the point?
I can completely understand why they don't think their vote makes a difference, but actually it does. I mean, I feel very strongly about this, being a Green councillor, because we're the fourth largest and we're, you know, seen as like someone who, oh, it's bit of a waste to vote. But actually, it's not. If you turn out and give your voice in that way, that is a positive step. It might not produce the result you want, but still, you've given your voice. And I can see why people don't want to vote, because they don't think it makes any difference. But I would challenge people to try and meet the candidates ahead of May. If you know your area at all, try and meet the candidates and see what they've got to say for themselves.
But people haven't necessarily got time to do that, have they? I mean, they generally tend to vote for a party, even though I would say it's more important in a way to vote for the person than it is for the party, because you get all different sorts. The other thing, of course, is, I mean, I invite people onto this show from all the spectrums, every party. I mean, I just named two that don't want to come. One is John Goulandris. He's a banker. I believe he works for Coutts, the Royal Bank. He doesn't even reply to emails or telephone calls. And then there's Simon Cook from the Liberal Democrats. He, you know, I think it's about 2 years I've been trying to get him to come and talk. And that seems to me also to be another reason why people don't want to engage. If they can't actually get to know who it is that's out there, and that the councillors, once they're elected, aren't contactable, then they're not going to vote for them.
Yeah, that's completely right. I mean, I sat between John Goulandris and Simon Cook at a meeting just on Tuesday, in fact, and I wasn't happy with the answers that they gave in that meeting.
Well, tell us a bit about them then, because they're not here to talk, even though I've invited them. So give us an idea who these people are.
They're perfectly nice chaps on a conversational level. The problem I find is that the people who have been involved in politics in the city for such a long time, they no longer think that some of the sort of organisations and BCFM and things like that, they don't really feel like they have to make any contribution to that. And
I mean, it's partly possibly because they're in safe seats. I know Simon Cook only just about squeaked back in, the Liberal Democrat, but certainly John Goulandris is in a safe seat. We've got also people like Dawn Primorolo, and a lot of the Labour Party in the south of Bristol are in very safe seats, and they tend to get a bit complacent.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think I think all of us who are in politics should just remove that as a matter of course. Just get rid of your complacency and get out and meet people, because that's where people are going to be first of all impressed by you. I think it's a matter of self-interest to go and talk to people, because then they'll know that you're listening and you're engaging, at least, you know.
Okay, Rob, over the last few months that you've been a councillor, what do you actually feel you've achieved anything? If so, what have you achieved?
Well, actually, there's something that's coming up that I can't really announce it yet. but I'm really, really happy that we've really fought, actually, very hard for continuing provision for St Paul's Learning Centre. That's what we've
crikey,
been
yes, there was the threat of closure.
Yeah.
So we can't be official, but we think that
we've been working
it may be
very hard behind the scenes and trying to get an agreement about how it's going to be funded from this point onwards.
Well, that is tragic that they were thinking about closing it. I know old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you were working there for a while, weren't they, when they first opened the learning centre in St Paul?
I was working for community education when it was opened up.
Okay.
Yeah, so give us an idea of how and why it was opened. I mean, because it just seems crazy now.
I mean,
it was shut.
My dealings with the centre have been fairly weak for a long time now. But when it was first opened, I think the problem was that the building itself had been funded by European money, and it kind of appeared a bit like a kind of spaceship in the middle of St Paul's with this brand new building with all singing, all dancing. But it was not clear that there was a budget to put stuff on in it. And I think this is the problem.
Yeah.
Is that you can have a big capital investment like that, but unless you've got a budget to do things, then it can easily come to grief. And of course, all the money that you spent on the building gets wasted. So this is why cuts are so damaging, because you know you've got all this infrastructure, and then if you don't actually do anything in the infrastructure, you've wasted the infrastructure spending as well as not actually hitting whatever targets you've
got. On the way here this evening, I passed Trinity Road Police Station. They're now talking about closing that.
Yes.
First, the custody suite and the station itself. I mean, isn't it? I'm trying to find some light at the end of the tunnel here, Rob, because it seems that even when you're saying my achievement since I've become a councillor is just to stop a closure, you know, is there really anything positive we can see in the future?
Well, that's one that's very, very topical, and that's
no. I mean, where we as the people, if you want, are taking the initiative, we are doing something positive rather than just stopping a disaster.
You want an example of a community initiative?
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a good example actually on my road in St Werburgh's. Actually, Saxon Road Green Space Group have been basically trying to get a small patch of land out of a very large expanse of industrial land that's owned by a company called Dainton Group Services. They're trying to put storage facilities on there for people to put all their extraneous crap, let's be honest, when they go away. And what the community there is trying to do is claim back that land and say, look, we want a small section of this land just for a meadow, just for a bit of a park space. just for our kids to run around in. Now, that's the kind of thing that I think is very strong in Bristol. Bristol has a very good history of that, of people taking the initiative and taking control over something like community land or a community centre. And I do think St Paul's Landing Centre will have more coming out of this, actually, and it can become a positive. It's more of an opportunity than a threat, actually, in many ways.
Yes, well, Martin, you know, what your thoughts about this? Because it does seem like we've got the big society going on here. This is exactly what Cameron wants. The council aren't doing anything, but local people are.
Well, I think there's always going to be people taking the initiative, one hopes. And I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, well, we're holding the line here and we're trying to preserve what's good. I mean, people have got to understand that we're in the biggest capitalist crisis for a generation. And people are very complacent about all of this. And all this stuff, oh, the politicians aren't doing anything. You feel like saying, well, no, because they've got no power, because it's been usurped by other bigger forces.
Most people that understand what was happening and actually experienced the 1929 crash in the 1930s here are dead now. And so, in a way, this is something that we've lost our community memory. Yeah. Can you compare what's going on now to 1929, do you think? Great Depression?
The big difference is that in 2008, the state all over the world didn't think twice about stepping in to bail out the banks. Now, that, in fact, was a plus in one sense. The banks didn't collapse.
So in the Great Depression, the banks did collapse?
Yes, they did. And the fact was that they pursued a more orthodox free market policy in the 20s and the 30s, which basically led to banking crashes.
But because of deregulation, we're in a situation now where banks could crash again in the future.
Well, that's what.
And what would the government do in that?
Well, Gordon Brown wrote an article in the New York Times just before Christmas, which is the first time he's actually said anything of
any note. Yeah, we discussed this last week.
And basically, the point he was making in that article, which is quite well researched, was that we are bowling along towards another crash, not a crash in Britain, not a question of who's going to run the next country.
Back to my question, what would the government do if there was another crash?
It's not at all clear.
They couldn't bail them out again.
It's not at all clear what would happen. Because what's happened, by bailing the banks out and pouring money into the accounts of the wealth-owning classes all over the world, because asset prices have been driven up by quantitative easing, so the wealthy have done very well out of the crisis. One of the reasons why they're not taking much of action to try and solve the problem is that the 1%, as the Occupy movement called them, have done very well out of the crisis. It's not a crisis for them. And the problem is that all the money that's been pumped into the system to keep it afloat has gone into their pockets. When people say there's no money left, there is, it's in private hands. Well, and the whole asset-owning class has benefited, but a tiny minority of that class have benefited
Martin,
even more.
Before World War II and the Great Depression, both sides of the Atlantic, governments spent, didn't they, in order to get the economy going again. There was lots of massive council house building over here, and great spending program over in the United States, Roosevelt spending. Mm-hmm. So what would happen this next time? Are the government in a position to do a similar thing again?
Well, no, because what's happened is that the bankers have actually just snookered the government by getting themselves bailed out. They've now got a situation where the government won't have the resources to bail out either. They won't be able to bail out the banks a second time, but they won't have any other resources to do anything else either. And then, of course, you get a situation where a small minority of the population, certainly of the planet, and of major countries like Britain and the US, will have all the assets. But they won't have got those assets by inventing a better widget. It's government intervention to support the banks which has allowed the wealth-owning classes
to consolidate their
gains. I mean, but it's got nothing to do with the free market. It's not a free market policy. It's socialism for the rich.
I mean,
it's a political decision to bail them out as opposed to other people.
A couple of decades ago, I visited South America, went round Bolivia, Peru, places like this where you end up with a tiny, super wealthy class and the rest of the country in poverty. Sounds like we're heading in that direction.
We are. And that's exactly where we're going. I mean, incidentally, I don't know if people saw this week that David Cameron went for a photo op with some woman that's managed to buy her own house under this Help to Buy scheme. And it turns out that she's an estate agent on 30 grand a year, and she's being given a hand up by the government. And you feel like saying, hang on a minute, why should she get a handout from that? And Royal Mail, it now turns out, has been undervalued by up to 70% of the price. That's all money taxpayers' money that belonged to everybody, which has actually gone into private pockets.
Well, it's interesting.
Now, ultimately,
yeah.
when the crash comes, those private pockets are going to be full, but there's going to be nothing left for everybody
one
else.
One thing I would say about those two stories, Martin.
We're going to be testing the political system to destruction in those circumstances.
One thing I would say about those two stories is certainly the way that the television news has dealt with them has largely been, well, we'll tell the original story, but we won't tell that we got it wrong the first time. I mean, if you have to read the newspapers in order to get the second half of the story.
It was the Daily Mail who picked up on the fact that she was a rather privileged person, and this was a handout for the already
well
being
run by PR, by the Alistair Campbells of this world.
Well, no, it's not. They are doing their job, but of spinning stories and trying to plant stories. Linton Crosby seems to be turning into a particularly nasty piece of work, pulling the string.
So, who's Linton Crosby?
He's the spin doctor for the Tories, and he comes from Australia, and he's won the Australian general election for the right wing there by pursuing the most divisive kind of rhetoric you can imagine. So there's a kind of race to the bottom going on in English-speaking conservative politics about who can be nastiest to immigrants, the poor, the scroungers, the other, the enemy, whoever that it is. But of course, if you start othering and creating enemies, eventually you can end up with a civil war, and that ain't funny.
What's the solution then? How do we get...
I was going to ask you that, Rob. You're an alternative party, slightly left field. What's the Green Party's answer?
Well, we have to try and minimise the influence of some of these large donors on our institutions, and it's not just institutions such as the banks and the government. It's also the media, and finding a way of getting the media to be something that serves people. And I know that's quite a controversial thing for a politician to say, because we're not supposed to meddle with the media, freedom of the press, and all that. But actually, I think we're at a position now where the media has so much power and control over how people think. It seems to me that we need to focus on that. I don't know exactly what the answer is, and that's why I was asking the question.
Okay, well, Martin.
Well, I don't think the answer is for people to say, I'm not going to vote, they're all the same. It's just silly.
Yeah.
I mean, what little defences you do have against this predation are in the political system, however ineffective it may be. The problem is not that the politicians are all the same and they don't do anything. The practice that the politicians... Think about what we've had a whole debate in this city about whether we wanted a mayor or not, which didn't engage the majority of the population who didn't care either way, but there was a very strong faction in the city who wanted a mayor, and it was being pushed by central government, so we all voted and decided just by a tiny majority that we would have a mayor. And then it turns out that all the mayor's got to do once we've elected him is carry out what the central government had decided anyway, which is £83 million worth of cuts. So that's the mayor's job, is just to front that up. Now, no wonder, I mean, in the past, being a local government politician was a recognised step to influencing national policy. Whereas if increasingly local government doesn't decide anything, and so why would people want to be councillors apart from, you know, this is the kind of thing that will start to come up.
There is an argument that it sort of purifies the role of a councillor in a way. I mean, I'm trying to put a bright spin on it, but basically it purifies our role, because basically we do become people who are just about looking out for the community's interests rather than trying to sort of make a step up to becoming an administration. But I don't see that either.
You're being like shop stewards trying to prevent we'll try and stop the worst from happening, and that's all we can do.
But we still have limited power, but we do have some influence. You know, I mean. I agree that is the problem, is that local government is so hamstrung by what central says. We've got to bring back the power to the local level. Fortunately, that only comes by having an administration in the central government who is willing to do that.
My New Year's resolution is to point out every week on here that we've got about as many people in Bristol as there are in Iceland. And Iceland has totally dealt with their financial crisis. They've jailed all their bankers, the crooked bankers, and also that's right. But I mean, a lot of them were influenced from...
But everybody knew who they were.
A lot of them were influenced by the City of London, weren't they? And so one of the things they did is they defaulted on all their debts, and the City of London had to sort of suck its thumb.
But the problem with that, from the global point of view, as Gordon Brown was pointing out in his article, which I thought was a good article actually, because it wasn't just going on about British politics, it was saying the system is actually out of control. And somebody like him, who's been a Chancellor of the Exchequer and a Prime Minister, whatever you think of him, he's not an idiot. And when he says the system is out of control, people should prick up their ears and listen.
Okay, well, talking about the system being out of control, probably the biggest story this week, I don't think there's much doubt about that, is the Mark Duggan inquest verdict this week, which was announced on Wednesday. I've got an article here from The Guardian. This perverse Mark Duggan verdict will ruin our relations with the police. Mark Duggan was demonised by police and the facts of his killing ignored. It seems to be the marginalised live in a parallel, unjust universe. after hearing the verdict in the Mark Duggan inquest, I went with his family, says the Guardian writer Stafford Scott, and friends to a local church in Tottenham, where we tried to share a private moment before facing the media. A range of emotions was on display, but it's fair to say that stunned disbelief and anger dominated. Rob, I'm going to ask you first about this, because it seems mysterious. I think it's probably the best way to put it. How someone can be shot in cold blood who's unarmed, and yet that is a lawful killing, and that the policeman that did it has no court case to answer, no murder charges, manslaughter charges or anything.
Yeah, and we've seen this recently as well with the Tomlinson case, where miscarriages of justice perpetrated by the police haven't been, the perpetrators haven't been brought to justice.
Now, Tomlinson was whacked by a policeman, wasn't he, who subsequently denied it, but yeah. Then finally it was actually captured on camera, and it was proven that he had whacked this guy who subsequently died.
Yeah, and the Mark Duggan case is another one where, but again, it's exactly what you said, is that people aren't seen on the same level in our society. They're seen as a different class, and we do have to do something to change that. From my perspective, community relationships need to be improved. Police and public relationships aren't always there to start with, if that's the starting point, I think. And bringing people down to the level, that's the real thing that I see that's quite strong, actually, and it's getting stronger in Bristol sometimes, is that actually sometimes the police are engaging and actually talking to people, but it doesn't happen enough. We need more people to sort of engage and talk around the issue, because too often we have these cases where people have huge miscarriages of justice, and then the justice system fails them.
Well, to be fair, this is the Metropolitan Police, and we're Avon and Somerset Police. Martin, what are your thoughts about the Duggan verdict?
Well, I think the verdict itself does raise questions, because the policeman who shot him was the only witness who claimed that he saw he had a gun. They claimed that he'd thrown the gun away, although there are suspicions that they planted the gun on the scene.
Well, one of the eyewitnesses said that they showed CCTV in the courtroom, and one of the eyewitnesses pointed out that one of the policemen had actually gone to the area after the shooting,
yes,
and it looked as if he'd just dropped the gun.
There was no crime of scene sealing off of it, as I understand. Now, all of these things raise questions. The other point that this chap made on the television, actually, was that the police were claiming that there was a shootout for 48 hours, and clearly they must have known from the very beginning that there was no shootout. So, in other words, what they're trying to do is get their word in first to spin it all in the right direction. And of course, lots of people have been killed in gang violence in London in particular in the last few years. Lots of people get shot, and we could end up like the United States of America, where 11,000 people a year get killed in the United States, 3,000 by the police. If we're going to modernise, and as the Tories want to take us to a more Yankee sort of society, more go ahead, more entrepreneurial, we better get ready to get used to people being shot by the police. But the real problem is that overall, the relationship between the police and black communities in particular over many years has not been good. I would suggest that in Bristol it's actually rather better than it is in other parts of the country, and that we need to build on that insofar as we can. But the real danger with all of this kind of class war from the top, which we were talking about in the last section, is that it is going to boil over. We had 5 people killed in the rioting that followed this event, and that was partly because the police didn't handle the demonstration that went to Tottenham Police Station very well. They started beating up the demonstrators, which kicked the whole thing off. All of these things are tinder waiting to go. And if you can't see major cities in Britain after a banking collapse looking a bit like Northern Ireland or Detroit, then you lack imagination.
Well, one of the things which has been spun by the police on the day of the inquest verdict and yesterday is that they're talking about putting cameras on the police in order to film these sorts of events and make sure all the evidence is there. But I would say, first of all, hang on, you don't need really a camera. You've got nearly 100 eyewitnesses that said the guy didn't have a gun, so why do you need a camera?
Well, the point being made by the sort of more conservative commentators is that it was the jury made the decision, but the jury made a contradictory decision. They decided that he didn't have a gun, but they decided that he was lawfully shot. Now, leaving aside the ins and outs of the Duggan case in particular, what is even more important in the wider, there have been many, many deaths in police custody, where and the Tomlinson case is a fairly obvious.
Well, there's something like 300, Martin, just the figures, about 350 deaths in 12 years.
Exactly, and it's widely believed in the black community and other marginalised communities that their lives don't count. Now, that that is a very dangerous thing to take hold. We've already got a million young people under the age of 25 in this country without work, and the potential for something really nasty is very definitely there. But I don't think we're going to get anywhere by exaggerating things. The police often get things badly wrong, and sometimes they get them right. They should be praised when they get them right, and we should be absolutely straight with them when they get it wrong.
Rob, Mark Duggan's mum has said that now if anything happens, if she's under threat, she can't phone the police. She doesn't trust them.
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing to say to that except that basically the level of trust there has got to be built up again. I mean, maybe it won't happen with her. I don't think she'll ever probably trust the police again. But I mean, taking an example from this week in Bristol, you know, the EDL came to Bristol in the last week, and we had 24 police officers stopping the anti-fascist protesters against the EDL from getting in between those two groups. And so, you know, from those 24 officers' perspective, I think they did probably their job quite well. So actually, we've got to look to the good examples of policing as well as the bad. And actually, the terrible instance of Mark Duggan, it has to serve as a warning to the police, and they have to do internally. They have to figure out a way of rebuilding that trust again.
Well, after the Lee Rigby killing, for example, the police stopped a small group of EDL people actually going down into Eastern, didn't they, as well? So,
right.
You know, there's all sorts of different aspects to this in different parts of the country. I think maybe, you know, this is something which is particularly...
Well, it's local knowledge by police, which they need, and local knowledge means that different communities will have a different relationship because the police are, you know, they've either got local knowledge or they haven't. I think in London, one of the problems is that you've got, you know, it's just too big and there's too much going on.
But even in that case, I mean, the local beat officer in my ward, you know, he's overrun with so many things to do that he doesn't get to do all the things he has to be able to do. I mean, it's partly because of the cuts in police budgets, but it's partly because there's such a diverse number of things that happen in the city now.
Rob, I love you because you've just given a fantastic cue into the Prime Minister's questions, and we're going to go to Prime Minister. You don't even realise that, but you have. And Prime Minister's questions now. We're going to hear from John Mann on that very topic.
John Mann. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Government cuts having closed the police cells in Bassetlaw. I now discover that the police are having to patrol villages using public transport. Which begs the question I'd like to ask the Prime Minister. If the police are waiting at a bus stop having arrested someone, should they go upstairs, should they go downstairs, or should they not arrest at all?
The first thing to say to the Honourable Gentleman is he didn't mention that recorded crime in the Bassetlaw Community Safety Partnership is down by 27% under this government. But what is so noticeable? But what is very noticeable is that every honourable member opposite is getting up and complaining about the need to make reductions in departmental spending. Frankly, this is like Back to the Future, Mr. Speaker. We are back now to where we were 3 years ago when we said you've got to make difficult decisions, you've got to make some cuts, you've got to get the deficit down, and they lived in total denial. They are back to where they were 3 years ago. It may be the new year. It's the same old Labour Party.
Rob, what are your thoughts about that, though? Because he's talking about similar things. I mean, the police cuts, we mentioned the possible closure of the custody suite and the police station at Trinity, and there are other closures on the cards. It seems that nobody is going to escape this cuts programme.
Yeah, this is the issue. I think it's terrible, the idea that Trinity Road shuts down. It's such a... I mean, people know where it is, for a start. I mean, there's other police stations that people don't even know where they are. Newfoundland Road, maybe people don't know that there's one down there, and the new Bridewell one, maybe they don't even know that one. So it's the fact that it's a centre for the community, and people know... I say that, what I'm saying is...
a centre for the criminal community.
Well, maybe it is, but it's also where a lot of people go and report crime. It's also... It's a key function of the local community to have a local police station. And in that area particularly, in Eastern and Lawrence Hill and the Old Market area, it's crucial to have that. And again, it does show the sort of the limits of what cutting things will do.
Why shouldn't police get on a bus and go to a village and do a bit of a patrol and then come back? I mean, the chances are, if they have to arrest somebody, which is highly unlikely, but if they do, then they can call out a panda car or whatever they call them nowadays and go back in the car.
I didn't have an objection in particular to the MP from Bassett Law, wherever, where he was from.
But I mean, we were also in a rural policing area. I mean, most of the Avon and Somerset area is rural. So, I mean, having the police on the bus, what's the problem?
I don't see a problem. I think, you know, that might be something that, you know, the flexibility you have to have now as a force. They must have to do all kinds of different modes of transport. And I think that's good, because people see that there's a difference in the way of approaching things. People don't just think Bobby's on the beat anymore, which is the thing that always gets brought up. Oh, we need more Bobby's on the beat, actually. Public transport, cycle, there should be a number of different ways. Sometimes they have to get on horses, apparently. I don't know whether that's needed. But,
Martin, would you like to see more police on first bus going down to Wales and stopping off in the villages?
Well, I mean, the fundamental point here is about cuts, isn't it? And the whole discussion about cuts is, we've got to cut, what are we going to cut? Now, when the crash happened 4 or 5 years ago, what I said at the time was, there's no case for cutting public expenditure here. What you've got to do is recoup the money that you've paid into the system to bail out the wealthy classes. I'll come back to the point I made earlier. The wealthy classes have done well out of the crisis because the government has intervened. Now, you've got to claw that money back, and you're not going to claw it back by leaning on the poor or cutting services that the poor need, including the police, because the police actually do most of their work in poor communities and are central to the well-functioning of those communities when they're doing their job properly. But, I mean, this whole agenda of cuts is wrong. What we should have been doing all along is saying, like, those who caused the crisis have to pay for the crisis. Well, the polluter pays.
You can
and
say...
We've now got a complete reversal. By bailing out the banking system, the bankers and their acolytes have now got a situation where they're telling everybody else that they've got to make sacrifices to bail them out, and that is what is happening.
Well, one
and
of them,
at a certain point, people will put up for this for a while if the economy seems to be improving. But if the banks crash, as I suspect they will, people are going to be furious because they will have lost everything, and these people will have everything.
Well, one of the most vicious,
the police will,
Martin,
not be enough to protect them.
One of the most vicious cuts has been to social care, $8 billion. This was also mentioned this week up at Westminster.
Libby Abrahams.
Mr. Speaker, the government has cut $1.8 billion from the social care budget, which means that nearly 500,000 fewer people are eligible for social care. With home care charges up £740 a year since 2010, and the government's care cap nothing more than a care con, why isn't the Prime Minister being honest with older people about the real care costs they will face under this government?
Well, what I'd say to the Honourable Lady is, of course, difficult decisions have had to be taken right across government spending. But actually, if you look at health and social care, we've protected the health budget, so it's going up in real terms, and we put some of that health budget, up to £3 billion, into social care to help local authorities. We now want to get local authorities and local health services working even more closely together to deal with the problems of blocked beds and making sure there are care packages for people when they leave hospital. In the areas of the country where this is working, you can really see the benefits, and we want to make that happen right across the country.
Well, sorry, I said 8 billion. It's actually 1.8, a piffling 1.8 billion of cuts to social care. Rob, what's your experience of the way social care has changed here in Bristol? Because, you know, we've clearly been told we've got to make cuts. A lot of it's been privatised, social care, and many of the care homes have been closed, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, in this year's budget, particularly, there's been a lot of older people services that have been taken out, but also a lot of the home care services. What I want to see is people not be who are vulnerable, who are not able to care for their own needs, be served. It's really difficult for me, from my own perspective in Bristol, to say what needs to change about the care system in the whole country. But in Bristol, we definitely need well-run publicly run care homes. It's part of our responsibility in society that we actually care for people at every stage of their life. And it can be older people, but it could also be people who are needing home care throughout their life if they're disabled. So,
but how can we do that? We've been told we've got 90 million over 3 years of cuts. How on earth can we afford to carry on caring for the elderly?
Yeah, and that's the issue, is that some of the ones that have been put up this time in the draft budget have been things like cutting warden service in some of the supported accommodation and things like that, and that's dreadful. How can we do it? We can simply make our argument and try and make sure that those things are ring-fenced. We've been very, very active in trying to keep those older people issues on the agenda, the Green Group. And actually, in our conversations with the Mayor and with Cabinet members, we've been able to make a couple of things. I can't talk about it too much because we're not at the stage where we're actually looking at the budget as a council. So, but those are some of the areas that we're actually, you know, trying to save and trying to find alternative alternatives to.
Martin, social care for the elderly looks like it's going down the tubes bit by bit, very little. And one of the reasons why we've got this crisis in accident and emergency is because actually there are no places outside the hospital once people are starting to recover for them to go to.
Yes, and I think what we should be doing is we should be looking at what the needs are in our society, because a crisis like the one we've had ought to be treated as an opportunity to say, well, what do we really want? Because that was all wrong. And in actual fact, I would see reflating the economy in the medium term by having a list of things like, what do we want? We want state-of-the-art nursery schools, state-of-the-art old people's homes. We want people... what happened in Bristol, where the home care services were privatised, that meant that people who'd been working in that service for years and were very well, absolutely professional in their jobs on £9 an hour, were removed so that private sector could take it over at £6 an hour. And that's, of course, if looking after people who, when they are ill and sick, is a very, very valuable contributions to society, and that people who do that job should be well paid and rewarded. It's very antisocial hours, and you need dedicated people.
Look,
and
it's all very well to say this, Martin.
And when it was run in-house...
It's all very well to say this, but we cannot afford it.
That is exactly the point I'm coming to, Tony. We can afford it. The money is all in the Cayman Islands. The wealthy classes have been bailed out by the banking system. The banking system has been bailed out. People have forgotten this. When we say we can't... when Cameron comes out and says this, that we all know that we've got to cut, and then the Labour benches say... And they're all going along with this. We've got to break this psychology. Ultimately, the only way out of the crisis, as in the US in the 1930s, is to spend more money on real people doing real things. And then you tot up what you need to do that, and then you don't just do it by deficit spending, you take the money off the wealthy classes. The money they've got has not come through building a better widget. It's come through government intervention, and through government intervention, it can be taken away.
Now, Rob, there's a consultation going on, I think, still. Am I right? It's still going on? The idea is that George Ferguson is saying to the people of Bristol, the great people of Bristol, well, have a look at the budget if you can bear it, and tell us what you think. Now, Labour leader Helen Hollander says she doesn't think that hardly anybody that's going to be affected by the budget has actually had a look. And also, of course, this consultation period's taken place over Christmas, where most people, their minds are certainly not on looking at what the budget's going to be.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's a good point. The consultation officially ended on the 30th of December, but people can still make their comments. It's all up online.
Is this consultation really mean anything? Is it just a paper exercise?
I mean, what I've heard, 12 times more people have participated this year than last year. So actually, it's been better than last time. Now, obviously, that means there's still loads of those people who haven't contributed. But apparently, the council has been in contact with about 50,000 people.
But isn't that what we vote for you to do? You're there to do that.
Yes, I agree. And I agree with... and I think Helen Holland should go and talk to her constituents and get their views on the consultation. If she's prepared to complain about it, she should be doing all her utmost to get people to comment on it during the time that it's available.
Well, leader of the Lib Dems, Tim Kent, has said that the new figure, apparently it's not 90 million, it's 83 million. I don't know quite where the council have found. Maybe you can help us tell us where the council have found this £7 million hanging around. Is it like in gold bars in the basement of the council house?
It's to do with what the government tells us about what they're willing to give us, basically.
Okay, well, Tim Kent has said that the 83 million is closer to the 80 million that we were always saying was the figure that we needed to be looking for.
Well, so, that's a huge moral victory for Councillor Kent there. I mean, it's his own government that is actually putting these austerity measures onto Bristol. So,
but is it as simple as we need to cut 30 million a year? I mean, I'm just dividing up your 90 million roughly into three years.
Effectively, yes. But I mean, you can you know, put more at the front and less at the back. And it seems to me that that has been the case, that they've put more at the front and less at the back. And St Paul's Learning Centre being put in the first year of the subsidy cut was an error, I think, a huge error from the start. And you can look at the portfolio holder for that particular one decision to see who that
was. Who's that?
Mr. Cook.
Okay.
And we'll see what happens. Basically, what I think is going to happen over the next 4 weeks is that all of the political parties, other than us, are going to be trying to make their own points, trying to score petty political points over something that is of utmost importance. Instead of working together, they're going to be working apart. We're going to be trying to work with the mayor, as much as we have some disagreements with him about some policy items. We're going to be trying to work to get a really good budget for Bristol. It's difficult because you've got huge cuts to make. And I don't like that, and we're an anti-cuts party, and I don't agree with the cuts, but we have to find some way to get the best for people in Bristol, and that's the situation for nearly every council in Britain, you know.
Okay, well, let's go to Her Majesty's official opposition now, fresh from his Christmas pudding. He does seem a little bit Christmased out, and this is Ed Miliband at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Ed Miliband.
Mr. Speaker, I thank the Prime Minister for that answer. I know he and the Environment Secretary will keep the House updated. He will recognise that some people felt the response at times was too slow. In particular, can he tell the House whether it's become clear why it took so long for some of the energy distribution companies to restore power to homes over the Christmas period, and what steps does he believe can be taken to ensure that that kind of thing doesn't happen again?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. In all these circumstances, no matter how good the preparation, there are always lessons to learn. And I think there are lessons to learn on this occasion. On the positive side, the Environment Agency Warning Service worked better than it has in the past. The flood defences did protect up to 1 million homes over the December and Christmas period. But there are some negatives there, and we need to learn lessons. I think particularly some of the energy companies didn't have enough people over the holiday period for emergency response, and I saw that for myself in Kent.
The fact of the matter, though, is, Martin, the Prime Minister cannot decide where there's going to be a downpour, when there's going to be floods, and when people are going to have their electricity cut off, can he?
No, I mean, normally when you play Miliband versus Cameron at question time, it's just a screaming match. I mean, that sounded like they were a Christmas dinner and trying to be extremely nice to each other for the sake of the relatives.
Not a lot of witty cut and thrust from Mr. Miliband at all.
Well, no, I mean, they all sounded as if they were
best of mates,
hungover from the festivities, didn't they?
Rob, what do you make of that? I mean, it doesn't seem to be like Her Majesty's opposition. It really doesn't seem to be that he is picking out important points about what the government are doing wrong and convincing the public that he's going to do better. He's just being kind of... It's almost like they're sitting around the fire at their sort of gentleman's club having a little chit-chat.
Yeah, that's true. But, I mean, my first thought was that he was ill, to be honest. I mean, if you're if you're leader of the opposition and you have a bad day, I've got a bit of a cold, it's probably what you sound like.
Well, should let Harriet Harman do the job.
But that's not the kind of macho politics they expect in Westminster, is it, Tony? That's the problem. I think the problem is that sometimes people have off days. I think he should be saying more than that. Yeah, he should be holding Cameron to account. Some of the PR decisions Cameron made over the Christmas period were ridiculous. He turned up at a village after they'd basically been completely abandoned for the whole of Christmas Day. I think that's terrible.
That's
thing
right.
To do. If only from a PR perspective.
Well, that's right. And certainly he was harangued, wasn't he, by some of the residents.
But can I say something about Bristol? Because yeah. I mean, if you look at Bristol's, go back to the budget again. I mean, look at how many reserves we've got in Bristol. Bristol is has the lowest reserves of any council of the core cities. We have very little that can actually help us if there was a situation with flooding in Bristol, and there is quite a flood risk. You know, obviously we're fairly coastal.
Okay, well, on to a topic which I'm sure is close to your heart, which as a green and environmentalist, we've had news this week that we've got four American states confirming that water pollution is coming in from fracking. The Associated Press have requested data on drilling related complaints in Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia and Texas. Extracting fuel from shale formations requires salt, chemicals, heavy metals and radiation. The most common type of pollution involves methane gas, and this is coming out of people's taps. Just the first para of this story from Associated Press, at least four states have nurtured the nature's energy boom. Hundreds of complaints have been made about well water contamination from oil and gas drilling, yet this is what we're planning to do down in the Mendips.
I mean, this is a scary technique, and it's an industrialisation of the countryside, basically, if we allow it to happen here. I would recommend your listeners watch a couple of films. Drill Baby Drill Bill was very good at showing how in Poland they've resisted fracking, where basically a company turned up out of the blue and decided they wanted a bit of land and took it, and how the community fought back there. And there's another one called Gasland from the States, which shows, you know, people turning on their taps and being able to light the fluid coming out of those taps on fire. Now, we don't want something that will contaminate water in this country, and we don't want something in this area, in the southwest region, that will potentially take up huge amounts of resources and carbon to actually produce very little in terms of our long-term sustainability aims. Our long-term aims are to move towards renewables. I think we all understand that, and none of the political parties will deny that that's where we need to be moving towards. But it's just how fast you want to go. The Greens have a very radical view about how we should deal with energy supply and change it for the better.
Now, Martin, what happens in the States is when they start doing this fracking, shale gas drilling, they ask for people who want to complain to send samples in, and then they check them to see which complaints are upheld and which aren't. In Pennsylvania, they've had 106 water well contamination complaints upheld. Ohio had 37, West Virginia 122 complaints, and Texas, their spreadsheet has more than 2,000 upheld complaints of water contamination due to fracking. I mean, surely this is a no-brainer. We don't do it here. And even experts in the States have said actually Britain is not suitable for fracking because the population density is way too crowded together.
Well, I mean, I tend to agree with that. And I think ultimately the answer to our energy problems is not to try and find new... We need to find new sources of energy, but we also just need to use energy more efficiently. I used to circulate a paper in Eastern Europe in the 90s by Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute, which basically argued that we could get virtually all the goals we're seeking in terms of reducing our environmental footprint through existing technology and using technology efficiently. And it's not even complex. All we've got to do is just make sure that we've got triple glazing, if necessary, whatever. I mean, in cold countries like Norway and so on, they've thought about this a long time ago.
A great book I read back in the 1980s, I think it was, it's called Most Secret War by R.V. Jones, British Scientific Intelligence from 1939 to 1945. R.V. Jones writes, in November 1944, reconnaissance showed that several sites of feverish activity had developed near Hechingen in Germany. We could not first make sense of them, and he's doing looking at these RAF photographs taken by Spitfires. But such activity in any event needed to be taken seriously, and the proximity of Hechingen made us wonder whether we had last found evidence of a frantic effort by the Germans to make a last-minute attempt at a nuclear bomb. He showed the photographs to F.A. Lindemann and Lord Cherwell, who immediately warned Churchill, and plans were made for further reconnaissance and for bombing. He began to feel that nuclear intelligence had really taken off, but within a few days the scare was dispelled. Wing Commander Douglas Kendall spotted that all the sites were in the same string of valleys and were all much on the same level. After a visit to the Geological Museum in South Kensington, he found a German geologist had reported low-grade oil shales in the area. It turned out the Germans were doing now that their oil installations were being heavily attacked was to trying to exploit this unpromising source of oil supply. Now, it seems this was a last-ditch attempt right towards the end of the Second World War by the Nazis, Rob, to get very, very easy, cheap oil, but it's not very good oil. Doesn't seem like this is the cutting edge of technology. It seems like it's the last-ditch attempt to get oil.
Yeah, and I think we're at a crisis, really, in peak oil. I was reading earlier today about oil prices going up again, and it's what I feel is that we're still lacking the consciousness to tackle it. Is that people don't really realise that we're at this situation, and we aren't making the lifestyle changes. I mean, it's all very well for me to rant at people about changing their lifestyle, but actually, I think that is part of it. We've actually got to take responsibility ourselves and find ways, as Martin's already said about energy conservation, but also find ways of tackling the transport system. You know, in Bristol, that's directly related in a sense to our consumption and the way that we use our resources, is that largely people drive into Bristol, and we need to find ways of making the transport system better so that we don't have to do that as much, so people are taking public transport and lessening Bristol's carbon emissions. We need a radical solution to some of the issues there. Yeah.
So what is your radical solution?
Well, for me, for a start, you know, we need a low emission zone. But for me, I do actually go a bit further. I don't think all my Green colleagues agree that congestion charge would work, but I do think it is something we need to look at in Bristol, because we've always tinkered around the edges. I mean, the residents' parking zones last year, I mean, it was obviously a very controversial issue, but it actually will reduce the number of cars coming to Bristol, I think. And that's only going to be a good thing, because it means people are using public transport, they're finding alternative
means.
But
why can't you make the public transport better and cheaper? And then people will use... This is called the carrot approach, rather than the stick approach. What people don't appreciate is just having another tax landed on them.
I agree completely. They don't like the tax. I'm afraid that when you put in one of these systems, it costs money.
I mean, for example, when the frequency of the service on the Avonmouth line was doubled, loads more people start using it. When the public transport is there, people will use it, Rob.
Of course, that's true. But I don't think it's a case that if you build it, they will come. I think actually you need to actually give people an incentive to leave their cars, which is not just putting on more buses or having better buses. Actually, one of the main things we need is to publicly own those services, the buses, the trains. It's a way of us actually saying, look, we've got control over this, and it's a publicly accountable thing. At the moment, we've got a number of private companies running our public transport in Bristol and in the rest of the country, and that needs to change. That's the one thing that I would change if I had had power in Bristol, because it's a fundamental importance to the way people get about and live their day-to-day life.
Okay, off up north a little bit to Birmingham now, and G4S have been running a giant super Titan prison in Birmingham, HMP Oakwood, to which quite a lot of people from around the Bristol area, I think, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think from Shepton Mallet Prison and like that, have been taken up there. And last weekend, we had riots. Now we're going to hear from one of the lawyers who represents people who are in the prison. He's Iqbal Singh Kang from the lawyer firm Gurney Harden, about the riots last weekend at HMP Oakwood, run by G4S.
My experience is I have numerous clients I represent there. I attend at that prison regularly, and I can see exactly the direction that it's going in. In fact, at the end of November, I had announced publicly that there would be a riot very soon, and as we've seen on Sunday night, there was. I'm announcing now that unless the government takes very urgent and immediate action to intervene and take responsibility for public safety and take its own responsibilities very seriously, then somebody will die. There's major problems within the management of G4S's running of HMP Oakwood. There's substantial failings in staff training and understanding. There's a lot of staff on the ground that lack experience, who have previously had little or no involvement whatsoever within the criminal justice system. They've been given next to no training. They've been placed in uniform in charge of the custody and safety of prisoners without very little direction or training and experience whatsoever. Obviously, experience is something that is gained through a course of dealing. When prison officers are working, they will gain that experience over a period of time. So that, of course, can't be taught. But what can be taught is training and direction through course delivery by people in positions of seniority and management, so that they have an understanding of the prison service procedures and the rules and regulations, so that prisoners are treated fairly and properly in accordance with national standards. As the Her Majesty's Chief Inspector of Prisons announced last year, is rife with illicit substances, unauthorised articles, there are 10 a penny. You have equivalent to knives, which are improvised weapons that prisoners produce for their own safety within the establishment itself. It's true of some jails. Of every single prison does have unauthorised articles within it, but the number of those unauthorised articles within HMP Oakwood is absolutely off the scale.
A famous quote from the Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons was that it was easier to obtain drugs in Oakwood than it was a bar of soap, Martin.
Yes, and should prisons be run in the private sector at all? I say no.
Well, The Guardian is saying also that the G4S lied to press and public about the length of this riot last Sunday. Disorder apparently lasted 9 hours, not the 5 hours which G4S had first claimed. What's the problem with private people like G4S, private firms running? I mean, we already know that fiasco to do with the Olympics and G4S...
Yeah, it's quite clear many of the personnel there are not, in fact, prison officers. They're people who are learning on the job. Mm. It's hopeless.
OK, thank you, Martin. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Green Councillor for Ashley, that is St Paul's, Rob Telford. After the news, Fallujah, Iraq.